So that's what we see here. By the way, nothing wrong with thinking about a variable, nothing wrong with really stopping and deciding whether you could handle that risk. The highest possibility is that we'll see at least 150 basis points reduction over the course of 18 to 24 months. Could be more. We don't know. And that would give you some relief over the course of 18 months to 2 years.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Strictly Money, where we discuss financial topics that matter. I'm your host, Sejal Patel. On today's show, we are talking about the state of housing in Canada. There's been a lot of talk about making housing affordable and bringing on supply, but what is really going on? And is any jurisdiction getting it right? My guest for today is Ron Butler. Ron is a mortgage specialist. He's a thought leader in the housing space. And he also has a terrific podcast called The Angry Mortgage. You got to check it out. He joins me now. Hi, Ron. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So, Ron, maybe we can start with what you're seeing in the housing market, maybe in terms of listings versus sales. And I should mention that you are in the Toronto area.
Yeah, we operate in British Columbia and Alberta as well. And we are in Ontario. Canada is a big marketplace. Definitely Alberta and Quebec are radically different than BC and Ontario. Right now, I'd say Alberta is slowing slightly, but still very good. They have massive provincial growth numbers in terms of population, and they have a supportive government toward the housing industry. They find ways to get houses built effectively and efficiently, and they do it very well, both in resale and on new construction. Go right there. BC, a bit similarly constrained to Ontario. Quebec's its own world. They have far lower immigration, although it's up, definitely. It's up, but it's far lower immigration than Ontario, British Columbia, and that we see corresponding sort of relaxed atmosphere in their housing industry and the house prices and their real estate costs and their real estate activity. Now, what's happening in Ontario, British Columbia, that's pretty very, very obvious in Ontario, that there are issues surrounding tiny condos, that market has changed, that the ability for landlords to depend on significant rent increases, people who own condos, small condos, their ability to get rent increases is greatly diminished from last year. They're probably been falling since August. And the certainty that the price of the condo will go up in a big way, which would support holding on to a negative cash flow condo. That idea of infinite up on pricing has pretty much died. And so depending on who that investor is, they may be thinking of selling. And we've seen a vast explosion in inventory in that space.
Oh, so that's really interesting. So you are seeing a lot more condos then coming up for sale?
Yeah, the numbers on the listings on condos are like at 10-year highs.
And, Ron, we are sort of in that spring season where, most people are listing their homes. Are you seeing demand being there? Because this is typically the time when people list.
Sure, you're absolutely right. The issues this year, spring barely sprung in Ontario. The issues this year really surround rates, the future of mortgage rates, and this continuing problem with investor capacity to take on new rental properties. I mean, it's pretty much flatline. And we always have to remember that in places like the GTA, where there's a lot of people, that's a whole lot of Canadians live in the GTA, the growth in real estate activity, if you go back to 2021, 2020, parts of 2023, the tremendous amount of that growth has been in the investor groups, people buying rental properties. And that's really taken a tumble. So yes, there are still people who want to buy homes to live in or upgrade homes. But in many ways, the interest rates are holding them back. They say, should I buy now if I expect interest rates to be lower in 6 months? And, I don't want to give up my 2.19 mortgage. If I'm going to sell and buy, I think I'd rather sit on it for now until renewal comes up. So there's a number of constraints that we do see that pop up all the time. And again, in all types of real estate sales in Ontario, we are continuing to experience a 10-year low.
I think most economists agree that we are going to see rate cuts. How fast they're going to come and how many is still sort of up in the air. But Ron, I want to go back to the point that you made about investors and we're not seeing as much. And you mentioned the fact that, the ability to raise rentals is not as good as it was last year. But the other thing that I am seeing, and I'm curious to know your thoughts, is a lot of landlords are getting frustrated because they're finding that they don't have the pull that they did before. So if a renter is not paying their rent, they can't evict. I'm just seeing a lot more dialogue around that. And I'm wondering if that plays a factor.
It's a very important factor. You know, if we think about it, over the last couple of years, literally everything that could go against landlords, small individual landlords, people who own like one or two units, everything that could go wrong has gone wrong, if you think about it. The Landlord and Tenant Board in Ontario continues to be an absolute catastrophe. It's not much better in British Columbia. It's understaffed, inefficient, bizarrely incapable of fixing itself. Even the Premier acknowledged the problems, swore that it would get better, and absolutely nothing's happened. So it's an unmanageable mess if a tenant stops paying. Also, the sort of more lucrative and potentially better way to rent out a unit, which is through Airbnb or short-term rental, that's gone to hell in a handbasket. That's become municipalities are moving against it, moving to say, well, wait a second, you've got to make sure that you live there before you rent a room out, and, you know, sort of actively moving against it. In British Columbia, for instance, it's more or less banned. The problem is banned the whole thing. In Toronto, we've got continuous moves to try to restrict Airbnb and short-term rental. So if you think about it, it's a perfect storm disaster for small landlords. It's the fact that the prices are no longer going up. Airbnb is in the process seemingly of being really harshly dealt with. The landlord and tenant situation is just a disaster, an unmitigated disaster. And even though rates may come down in the next 6 months, we're not going to need 2.4 rates again. I mean, that's not in the cards. So it's everything that you can imagine could go wrong. Pretty much house cover.
I do wonder, Ron, if governments are shooting themselves in the foot, because on one hand, they do have to rely on investment properties unless they're willing to get into the business. And I don't know, you might know more than I do, but I'm not really seeing that happen, at least yet. So yeah, you wonder if they're shooting themselves in the foot.
Well, government actually is getting involved in purpose-built rentals. CMHC has committed $30 billion to support mortgaging on new purpose-built rentals just this year. So which is actually more bad news for small landlords, that they are going to be in competition with REITs, new build REITs. It's been growing. It's been steadily growing. It's been growing slowly but steadily. There was no purpose-built rentals for almost a decade. It's almost non-existent in Ontario. It's come back to life in Ontario. British Columbia is actually doing a ton of that, and it will directly compete with small landlords. So again, more bad news for the landlord style investor, but although that takes some time to come out straight. And maybe those purpose-built rentals that we're talking about, $30 billion worth of low interest loans. We should make a point that the government isn't actually spending that money. They're just supporting the low interest loans. And that will result in another 4 years in a bunch of more competition for rents from a source that's, you know, they're different. They're not full of amenities. There's no doormat. There's no nothing. And they can deliver because of they have very low interest rates. They have very long amortizations. You go up to 50-year amortizations on some of those loans. And they are going to be more active competition. It's going to take time, but it's going to be more active competition.
Okay. Well, it's good. I think that's good news that there is more supply coming on, because we need it, and not necessarily always housing, right? I think we need more apartments. And I've always said that for many, many years, not just condos, but actual apartments. Ron, there was a lot of talk about the mortgage cliff. You know, a lot of people were scared. Are you seeing any evidence of that? Or is it too soon that could come?
Well, it's a great question. And it's sort of got two answers. The mortgage cliff probably turned out to be more like a hill. The renewal cliff turned out to be a hill, because we have one big bang that continuously increased the payments on their variable rate mortgages. Well, four other big banks had no change or very muted change in their payments as the interest rates went up. As you can realize, we went from 0.25, like 0.25, all the way to 5% in a very short period of time. Steepest increase in rates by steepness in the history of Canada. Sure, rates have been higher, but they never went up that far that fast. So as a percentage, it's incredible how far they went up. So what we're looking at is the fact that they just have to adjust, and four banks don't adjust their interest rates all up. Four-based degree adjusts very much on the payment. It was, some of it was purely voluntary. And right now, some people have mortgages where they're paying off zero. Some mortgages are actually growing. So the payment is not sufficient to cover the interest. And the mortgages actually get bigger every month. In many cases, with some banks on variable, these are all about variable rate mortgages, the banks just, it's just $5 a month towards interest. That's all it is. So yes, that's a concern. And those are, will all renew. Most of those will renew in, not this year, but in 25, 26. That's where the bulk of those will renew. Now, what happens to the people who are used to, say, a 3.6 rate that renews this year, and all of a sudden it's a 5.4 rate? Yeah, it's a struggle. Sure it is. But Canadians are resilient. We've seen it. The default rates are extremely low, still extremely low on mortgages. We see other defaults climbing. We see car loan defaults climbing. We see credit card defaults climbing, all the rest. Okay. But Canadians seem to continue to struggle hard to make those house payments. So far, we haven't seen any incredible disaster. But by the same token, the bulk of the variable rate renewals will occur in 25 or 26.
Yeah. And to your point, that's exactly what I am seeing. And I think, you know, people want that roof over their head. They're going to do whatever it takes to pay their mortgage or at least meet the minimum. But like you said, I'm also seeing evidence. There is evidence of credit card debt being, you know, racked up and delinquencies and people cashing out some of their retirement savings. So that's a concern, certainly for me. Ron, to your point, for those who are seeing their mortgage come up for renewal, what would you suggest? Do they go fixed? Do they, knowing that the rates are probably coming down, but would you suggest they go fixed now or variable, and how long of a duration?
Well, people have to have a degree of personal comfort. What's going on? I mean, some people have been so shell-shocked by variable, they've said, I'm never going to go variable again. It just scares the hell out of me. So what we can tell you, that three-year fixed is probably a bit of a sweet spot right now, because in reality, a year from now, rates will be less, but the one-year rate's 6.4. So nobody's picking that one.
So, why is it so high?
Well, because the one-year rate is really not a securitized product. You can't sell it off into a bond. It has to just reflect what GIC rates are plus a premium. So if GIC rates are 4.9 and the mortgage company needs a percentage and a half, the bank needs a percentage and a half to run the whole process of getting the mortgage finished. Because remember, it's only 1 year. You're not guaranteed they'll still be there after a year. So you've got to load all of your underwriting costs, all of your acquisition costs, everything into 1 year. And so you add 150 basis points to a one-year GIC rate and you get 6.4. On the other hand, if you look at a three-year, that's something you can sell into a bond. As you know, bond yields reflect that, those rates, and you have a much better opportunity to get a better rate. So that's what we see here. By the way, nothing wrong with thinking about a variable, nothing wrong with really stopping and deciding whether you could handle that risk. The highest possibility is that we'll see at least 150 basis points reduction over the course of 18 to 24 months. Could be more. We don't know. And that would give you some relief over the course of 18 months to 2 years.
Okay. Good point about the 1 year. I didn't realize that. Ron, we're going to take a quick break and hear from our sponsors, BMO ETFs, whom without I would not be able to do the show. We'll take a break and we'll be right back. Plug your ears, men. Ladies, if you're ready to build your financial freedom framework with me supporting you all the way, and you're sick and tired of spinning your wheels, you're overwhelmed with all the noise and jargon, then I've got the perfect solution for you. Join my free money masterclass, where I'll teach you my six-step trademark framework on how to retire comfortably. And you'll get an exclusive offer to my online financial program that more than 1,000 women have gone through. I've been in the financial industry for more than 20 years, and I'll teach you everything I know. So if you're ready, head to the show notes and sign up today. You gotta hurry though, because spots are limited. I'll see you on the other side. Welcome back. I'm here with Ron Butler, a mortgage specialist and a thought leader in the housing space. Ron, let's talk about solving the housing crisis, which has been a crisis for at least a couple of years. And, you know, you hear a lot of announcements from governments. It still, to me, sounds like there's a lot of smoke and mirror. I want to get your thoughts. Are we making progress?
Well, we take a few steps forward, we take a few steps back. As I mentioned previously, the program to introduce more purpose-built rentals is a positive one. Nobody could possibly say that's a bad idea. But then we take a few steps back at another level of government. We have municipal governments all over Ontario and some in British Columbia that just keep raising development costs. They don't raise them by 2 or 3%. Sometimes they raise them by 20%. Back in 2021, John Tory, the mayor of Toronto, raised it by 49%. So we're talking about taxing new bills. The lie that keeps being told by the politicians is, well, that's the developers should pay that. The people who are building the units should pay that. They don't. They just pass them on directly to the buyers. That's just the way economics works. That's the way the world works, right? So that is nonstop still to this day. We see a couple of municipalities are getting in trouble with the federal government who has provided money through a housing accelerator fund. Federal government's talking about withdrawing the money because these municipalities keep increasing these development charges. So look, it is a sad day when you have local politicians who, by the way, are typically only elected by about 16 or 18% of the people in the town or city, less than a low voter turnout, who are just doing things to help the older cadre of NIMBY homeowners, old people like me who own houses. So they're the voters, and they don't like property tax increases. So they keep heaping the cost increases onto first-time buyers, which is a horrible, horrible concept. So we have some progress, we have some failures. Probably a positive thing will be the severe reduction in international students, which was declared by the government in the last 6 months, and probably a reduction in temporary foreign workers, just to take some of the pressure off in terms of, you know, we were victimizing these kids from other countries. We were absolutely victimizing them. We were terrible, taking horrible advantage, like evil diploma mill colleges, just ripping them off for worthless, you know, online diplomas. Horrible stuff and just enriching themselves. I'm looking at one that increased it in 4 years. They increased enrollment 1,344%. I mean, I don't think they really had the capacity to provide great teaching if you're increasing something 1,300%. So, you know, just a pure rip off. We're going to see that decrease. That'll take some of the pressure off some of the housing stock in certain big locations, Ontario, British Columbia. But look, we are not making that progress we need to make, because as much as government tells you that we're going to build 3 million homes in Canada, extra homes, more homes, we're not. We're going to build less homes in 2023 than we built, in 2024 than we built in 2023. That's the truth. So the empirical evidence is that the failure continues.
Ron, I want to go back to the land development costs, because I was shocked, you know, and I have this conversation with a lot of people. And I said, you know, that $1 million home that you bought, you're paying about $300,000 of it to taxes, you know, and we all gripe about taxes. Like, I think we are, you know, just overtaxed in this country. And then I don't think people realize $300,000 of your money, which is probably financed, so you're actually paying a lot more, is going towards development costs. Why is it so high?
It's so high because the cities, municipal governments and cities, are very free spending. I mean, this has been the mantra of every level of government in Canada for the last decade, is that we'll just hire more people, spend more money on stuff, have more programs, do more stuff, and the taxpayer just keeps throwing more money at us because we can make them do it. You know, when you increase development fees 49% in 1 year, that's to try to fund something. Look, I mean, I realize cities have it hard, and big cities have it hard. There's lots of stuff going on. But if they don't take active measures to reduce their costs, and finally, most importantly, if they just don't come clean with their property tax participants and say, look, we can't burden brand new buyers with all these costs. You've enjoyed the use of your property for 21 years or 24 years. You've got to pay more, but they're afraid of that because they're afraid of getting voted out. So better to hide in development fees. And we're seeing it all come home to roost. As you said, $1 million house, over $300,000 is some form of tax fee, levy, park charge, it never ends. That's not good. That doesn't even make sense.
I know. And the U.S. does do it differently, right? They have lower development costs, but they have higher property costs or property taxes.
Yeah, they have higher property taxes. Yeah, they have, in some cases, much higher property taxes. You get a state like Texas, it doesn't even, my recollection is it doesn't even have state income tax. And you, the developer only pays for the roads and the power and the sewers and the water. That's what the developer pays. They pay the actual cost of what it takes to create the subdivision. And then the property owner, the owner pays the rest. And it's a lot more. But it's a state where when you buy that house, maybe only $25,000 was a development cost. That's all it was. So big difference in the cost of the house.
I want to circle back to Alberta, because earlier in the show, you had mentioned that even though the population of Alberta has grown, they seem to be doing something right that other provinces aren't. What is it?
Well, first of all, Alberta doesn't restrict in the same way other provinces do. It doesn't restrict where you can build housing, where you can build some of it. They say, look, if the farmer's willing to sell and it's not, you know, a vitally important watershed, build some houses. You know, we actually in Ontario erected a fence, a phony fence around the GTA called the Greenbelt. And you can't, you just run up against the wall. You can't build any farther. So when people say, well, the Greenbelt's a great idea, we need to protect farmers. The news that I've got to tell everybody in Ontario is every house in Ontario was built on something that used to be a farm. Okay, like every single one, like every house in Burlington, Mississauga, Ajax, even in the city of Toronto, they were all farms once. And we built houses on them because we had to. And no one here is starving, particularly me. You know, I'm not missing any meals. Okay, so what I'm trying to explain is that our ideas of what really is true or false is maybe possibly just to the advantage of developers. Because if you build a fence around a city, the developers who bought the land 30 years ago now have leverage to make it, the land worth an incredible amount of money. Whereas if you just said, you know what, we're going to build a 400,000 person suburb between Barrie and, I don't know, Newmarket, and we're going to provide a highway and we're going to put in a train and we're going to do things that make sense so we can, our population can expand sensibly. Those people who thought they would leverage this, these millions of dollars in little pockets of land wouldn't get the same leverage. I mean, there would be a whole new subdivision. I know there's just a million people saying, no, 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 Ron, you can't do anything with the Greenbelt. Again, every single house in the GTA was built on a farm originally a long time ago. And we're all still here.
And that comment often comes from people who already have their home.
Every single time, I mean, often, and I'm
not saying, you know, I do think, yes, we have to protect farmland. You know, one of the and I'd love your thoughts on this, because one of the things that I've always said too is building apartment buildings or condos that are 300 square foot places doesn't help, right? I don't think actually everyone wants a house, but they do not want to live in a shoebox either. And we really haven't given them much options. And I'll tell you, Ron, I lived in Singapore. Everyone lives in a condo. I mean, families of, you know, six live in a condo, but it's well built. You got three spacious bedrooms. You have storage. It just makes sense. We don't do
that
here.
No, we don't. We, and here's the most interesting thing to your point. Everybody who buys one of those 400 square foot shoebox condos doesn't live in them. They don't live in them. They rent them out. Like the people who actually bought them couldn't see themselves living in them under any circumstance. And now when they've come to try to sell them, they've discovered, oh, look at that. Nobody else wants to live in them either. So wait, but your point is terrific. We don't have to have endless sprawl, but surely we should build something where people feel comfortable living their lives. I mean, we just haven't done.
Yeah. And I'm not saying you can't have a 500 square foot place, but I mean, how many bachelors are you going to have? Or, you know, one person, like some people, you want to be able to, if they're in the city and they have one child, they probably want to live in an apartment, but you're not really giving them that option.
If people are wondering why the fertility rate fell off the cliff, that might be, you might have just given an answer. You're right.
I actually think that is part of it. I really do. There has been a lot of ideas floated around, like, you know, using federal land. I think the other one is speeding up approval, which is atrocious here. If I'm correct, it takes something like 6 or 7 years to get approval for a land, whereas in the US, it takes about 2. Any thoughts on that and what the problem is?
Well, it depends on the state, too. If you're in Kansas, it might only take 6 months. Look, we have created a bureaucracy that's eating itself. If you look at say, houses that were built in the 1970s. Those houses required about two reports to get built. Like, you had the developer of that subdivision had to make sure that the water table stuff worked, had to make sure there wasn't any clear, dangerous geological formations. Today, you need 24 reports. 24 reports before you can get started with the permit. Now, here's the important part to consider, too. All of those houses we built in the 70s, none of them fell down. Like, they didn't all just cave in. There's people living in them right now all over Ontario.
In fact, I would argue that the newer ones are probably going to fall down because they're pretty crappily built, I got to tell you.
Some are. Some of the, I really got to question some of the glass towers that flew up downtown and about, anyway. I don't pretend to be an engineer, so I won't comment on it. But the truth of the reports and the length of time and the complexity of approvals is real. It's just real. So if that's going to be the limiting factor, we're doomed because there's nobody trying to end the 24 reports. There's nobody trying to reduce the 24 reports down to 10 or 8 or 6. There's not even an attempt to try.
Well, Ron, the conversation's going to continue and we're just going to have to see how this all unfolds. It's been going on for a long time and I really do appreciate you coming on and sharing your thoughts. Now, Ron, before I let you go, I always ask my guests three rapid fire questions. So are you ready to play?
Sure.
Okay. What is the best financial advice you've ever received?
Save first. When the money comes into your account, automatically have some come off the top.
Yeah. Pay yourself first. I love that one. Okay. Then what is the worst financial advice you've ever received?
You should look into these NFTs.
Hey, they did well for a little bit.
For about 10 minutes. 10 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah. And then who knows what happened to that. Okay. Last one. If there was a law that you could enact that would help people with their financial wellness, what would it be?
Financial literacy. Be made available in a simple, effective, and free way, not for kids in high school who don't actually care and won't pay attention. But let's develop some courses, free courses, done beautifully, with great teachers, great speakers, for people who are about 25 years old who are really launching their financial path. Nobody 17 years old is going to pay the slightest bit of attention to any of the financial literacy stuff in high school. Maybe 2% of the people. But when you've actually gotten out, gotten a job, had to pay some bills, you may be renting on your own, your interest level is raised. And that's when we should do the financial literacy stuff.
Yeah, there's always a trigger, isn't there? I mean, and you know, Ron, this is my entire business. It's financial education. And I have courses and I run workshops. And I have found it's really hard to convince someone that it's important until something happens. That's usually when you hear. All right, Ron. Thank you so much again for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, that does it for this show. Don't forget to subscribe. If you haven't, leave a review. Please share this episode and check out the previous ones so you can build wealth and wisdom. We'll see you back here next time. Stay well, stay wise, and stay wealthy.